This is episode 46 of the Fifth Estate Podcast, Erica Greeter and the Mainstream Media Bubble.
Hey there, Fifth Estate fans. Neil Doing here with a special guest to tell you about Blue Apron. And who better to talk about Blue Aprons than former president Bill Clinton?
Hi, Neil.
Take it away, Billy.
I am so excited about this. I really appreciate you having me on to talk about this because I love blue stuff. Blue Apron. Oh, man. I've heard a lot about it. Can you tell me more?
Well, Mr. President, Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone.
Even Hillary? Oh, that's good because, you know, Hillary, she's a terrible cook.
Don't we know it, sir? Blue Apron does this by supporting a more sustainable food system and setting the highest standards for ingredients, as well as building a community of home chefs.
Now, how old are those home chefs?
Can Sir, they be the any ages age? Vary.
All right. That's good news. I'm happy to hear about that.
You know what else you'll be happy to hear about, sir? It's fantastically affordable. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron will deliver seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. And these are very easy to prepare. They come with step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe cards and pre-portioned ingredients. They can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. And let me tell you something, Mr. President, cleanup is a breeze.
Now that's a great, great feature. I'm so excited about this, Neil. Anything else? I mean, affordable. I love that because you know what? That's great for the middle-class person. I'm so thrilled that middle-class people will experience the change of cheaper, less expensive food. Good food, but less expensive, right? Is that what we're talking about? Go ahead, Neil, you finish up.
I'll tell you what, Mr. President. Let me tell you about some of the upcoming meals here. We've got spinach and fresh mozzarella pizza with olives, bell peppers, and ricotta salata. We've got sweet and sour salmon with bok choy, carrot, and ginger fried rice. Parmesan crusted chicken with creamy fettuccine and roasted broccoli. And we've got baby broccoli and Fontina paninis with hard-boiled egg and arugula salad. Now, I'll tell you, Mr. President.
What's hard?
Nothing's hard here, Mr. President, unless you want it to be. Mr. President, these are fresh, affordable, flavorful options that anyone can do. So, to all our listeners, you can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/fifth. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Mr. President, take us out.
That's Blue Apron, not Blue Dress. blueapron.com/fifth. All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you?
Well, Jay, I must confess I ate a truly irresponsible level of steak just before we went to air, and so I am a little drowsy.
Nice. But does that exist? Is there such a thing as an irresponsible amount of steak?
We're about to find out.
We'll learn before the end of this episode, that's for sure. Speaking of the episode, before we get started, of course, one of the things that we like, that Neil especially likes. Neil is a compliment guy. If you can compliment Neil, he's a happy man. And when you guys out there in podcast listening world go to iTunes and leave reviews, positive reviews, and 5-star ratings and all that kind of stuff, Neil's very happy.
Well, first off, what Jay is saying is a lie. Compliments never quite satisfy me. It's always, well, that was nice. How about another? It's a bit like being addicted to heroin, I think. I don't know. I've never been addicted to heroin, but I am addicted to compliments. And for the purposes of this show, that translates to reviews on iTunes as well as five-star ratings. Now, if you could give us some of those, that helps keep us in front of people. That helps grow the show. And, you know what else helps grow the show? Talking us up to your friends, your neighbors, your mom, whoever you think might enjoy the fine content we're putting out for you people.
Subscribing is what Neil is kind of alluding to. We like when people subscribe to the podcast. That always helps with the people who are willing to actually pay us money for these things. But we enjoy that, though. Anyway, so Neil, this week, always talk about the media, in the media. Conservatives have long said that, the media, the mainstream media exists within this kind of bubble that, they don't get out of D.C. and New York and everything. And, this week, Politico.
Right. There's always been this idea that the media is biased one way or the other.
Right.
But the idea that the media is literally ensconced in a bubble and closed off from the people they are ostensibly speaking to is a relatively recent phenomenon, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it certainly is. And, it's funny. This piece came out written by Jack Schaefer and who's the other guy that helped write it? Tucker Daugherty. And, people were just kind of raving about it because it was especially conservatives who saw it somewhat of as an admission mm-hmm. of, something that people have been saying for the longest time. And I don't necessarily think it's been conservatives. I would say other people have said, the mainstream media exists inside a bubble. And there's been lots of talk. Chris Arnotti, who we had on the show, and Selena Zito kind of argued that the media was not really paying attention to people who were, supporters of Donald Trump, who you might not think would be supporters of Donald Trump, in that kind of context, saying, you're missing something here.
Right. And I think the thing about bubbles is that what you have is not so much a conscious choice to ignore stories or developments, but stuff just does not get through the bubble, which is a very interesting idea and one that I think I'm glad is being discussed at more length. And to that end, we're gonna continue this discussion right along here. And we have with us for this episode, Erica Greeter.
Yes, she's hi. Hi. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So, Erica, I was first introduced to you. We haven't actually met, but I'm the first time I had heard of you or came across you were actually on Morning Joe, and it was a couple of years ago. Was it 4 years?
It was. I remember because I was in studio. I think I was on one other time, maybe, but. Kind of Facebook does those like this thing you were doing X many years ago. So like lately I've been getting like a flurry of like, here's this time 4 years ago when you were in New York on like a TV show. Here's this thing you were doing. It was really glamorous because it was a book launch. So I wrote a book. It came out April 4 years ago. And so now I'm being reminded of, my adventures on in the coastal bubble.
Yeah. So, okay. See, I remember you being on the show. For some reason, I thought it was like, I couldn't remember exactly what you were talking about. It was just one of the things I remember you were on, and I'm thinking maybe it was 2015 and she was talking about Ted Cruz or Rick Perry or something like that.
I've been on, I think, like via satellite later on from that. That's great. I'm glad you found me.
Yeah. And then, so, I followed you on Twitter and, you have interesting things to say and you're a great writer as well. So when I saw that you read the article and I saw you making some comments on it, on Twitter yesterday. And so I was like, hey, let's go ahead and see if we can get Erica on the show. We had kind of talked before about having you on. I thought this might be a perfect, opportunity. So let's go ahead and get into that and kind of, before it. Just so everybody else knows, some people may not know, go ahead and tell everybody about yourself and then just kind of go into what you thought overall. Just kind of give us a 50,000 foot view of what you thought about the piece.
Sure. So I'm a journalist based in Texas, based in Austin, Texas. I'm from San Antonio, Texas. And I've been in journalism about 10 years, first for The Economist, based here in Austin, but traveling the state and the surrounding states. And then for 4 years at Texas Monthly, where I followed Texas politics quite closely. So, of course, that was an interesting time to cover Texas politics closely. I left the Monthly in November and now I'm working on a few different projects, thinking about what we'll do next. But certainly, I mean, keeping an eye on these issues. And the article you mentioned, the article talking about, of course, jumped out to me because it touches on a, it makes a point that, you know, I think all three of us here can understand very easily, and that I certainly have seen as an issue throughout this election cycle, especially, which is that, you know, we think there are all different ways to talk about the media being biased or the media being skewed and, you know, either direction or many directions. But one thing, one way we don't talk about a whole lot is just like the geographic concentration of media on the coast. I mean, just the, literally people are in newsrooms in DC, New York, California. And so Jack Schaefer and Tucker Doherty went through and they kind of used the data they could find to sort of actually put measures on that to sort of track how many publishing industry jobs are in blue counties versus red counties. And kind of did like the heat map then, just kind of visually depict something that we've known for a while, but we don't really think about as a geographic issue. So as you know, part of the Texas bubble, like the mini bubble that's in Travis County, Texas, I was happy to see this discussed.
Well, if you look at the map of where these publishing industry jobs are concentrated, you can see there's this great big contiguous blob from stretching from DC up to Boston, right? And then and then there's a slightly, you know, a large, you know, dot over there in Los Angeles, San Francisco. There are some, you know, very, you know, you can tell where like the big cities are that kind of corresponds to this. But it is really, you can see it's a coastal phenomenon, these internet newspaper publishing industry jobs. But the internet publishing is dramatic. I mean, the dot that they see, you know, that they show for California, it's almost as big as the entire state. You know, the dot showing, you know, the concentration of these internet jobs for the Northeast Corridor is humongous as well. And then there's you know, the Upper Northwest and Chicago, and that's about it. Which, you know, it really does say something about, you know, the people who are generating this content that we're reading on the internet. They are located, boom, in these places, these two places, essentially. They're part of that community. That's where they live. That's what informs their values. That's what informs what they're interested in. That's what informs what they talk about.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny that the internet jobs are even more concentrated in these areas because, I mean, if you think about it, like, for better or worse, the internet should make it much easier for there to be more spread, right? And we have all
exactly
these publishing tools and communications tools in our pockets all the time. You know, the three of us are talking. I'm in Texas, Jay's in Atlanta, you're in Norfolk, Virginia. So there's new opportunities for us to communicate from different parts of the country. And it's striking that's actually, that we're seeing the opposite effect.
Right. The whole democratization of content thing, that didn't seem to work out so much.
Yeah, and so one thing I would say, I mean, and I kind of had this reaction reading the article, is that as is the case with all these metrics or all these ways of kind of thinking about intellectual or philosophical diversity, they're pretty reductive, right? So think about the small bubble that is in Travis County, Blue County. So, like, I live in a Blue County, I live in Travis County, but it's not the same kind of Blue County as it would be if I lived in Los Angeles or San Francisco or New York. I mean, it's Texas, right? And the bubble includes, I mean, people like me, but also people like John Davidson and MG Opria, who write for The Federalist, who live about half a mile from me. It also includes Alex Jones, who has a studio in East Austin, like not that far from us either. So I mean, we have to take all these metrics with a grain of salt because there can actually be quite a bit of political, experiential variation, even in the bubbles. But with that said, I mean, it's a different angle on topic. Jay, I think you mentioned that you saw people raving about it, and I was interested in that because I didn't quite track all the sort of reaction to the story itself from other journalists, but I kind of got a sense that from some journalists, maybe more mainstream media journalists, that they were a bit that they weren't gushing over it in the same way. They were a bit
I think it wasn't mostly. I should say temper that by saying it was a lot probably more conservative people who were saying people
Which
need to
sense,
read this.
Yeah.
that, you know, because again, it was kind of an admittance. And I'm, you know, talking about, you know, when, you know, we were kind of talking offline before talking about, you know, the liberal media. I don't like the term liberal media. I never use it because it projects. I think it projects kind of a conspiratorial element. And yeah. So what I say is I think the media is definitely biased, but I think it's the personal biases of the reporters and journalists. Basically, they think that they're keeping it out of their reporting, but it's just a natural tendency to do it. You know, they're never going to say, for instance, they'll never say pro-life. They're always going to say anti-abortion, you know, and they don't understand how that word has a connotation that doesn't hold with the people who consider themselves to be pro-life. I'm not anti-abortion. I'm pro-life. It may seem minute, but it's actually, you know, it's a little different. People who are pro-choice never want to be called pro-abortion. They hate it, you know, when that label is attached to them. So I do think it was mostly conservatives who were saying, look, this is what we've kind of been talking about. But I also think that you'd made a couple of comments about, you know, about the whole bubble thing, and trying to see where it was here. You know, you called it, what was it? Epistemic liberalism. And you said there's no need to be relativist about the truth or feckless about empirical standards, just more realistic about perspective. What kind of explain what you meant by that?
Well, so I've actually been thinking of it a lot, and I majored in philosophy, so according to Marco Rubio, I'm a philosopher now, I guess. But I think of this kind of thing a lot. How do we know what we know? How do we convey what we know? How do we substantiate what we know to an audience? And I think as journalists, like, we're trying to do our best, and of course there are limitations on our perspective, on our data sets, even just in things like covering politics, like we can't read somebody's mind. So at that level, we're trying to figure out what their interior states are without being able to directly access them, right? But what I was thinking about was, and so as you say, I think that for conservatives, there was a sense that the piece was kind of an admission or a sort of honest engagement with a point that conservatives have made very often, occasionally in a pretty contentious and conspiratorial way, which helps explain why everyone's so in their bunker, right? But I was trying to say, look, it's not like, and we're all in a bubble of some kind. Like, we're just, it's not necessarily an ideological bubble. It's just that we have had different experiences and we inhabit different corporeal forms and we have different people we talk to and we go about our lives in like different neighborhoods. And so even if you're doing your best to be scrupulously quote unquote objective in telling a story or telling it as straight as possible, you're still picking which story to tell. You're still, you know, calling the sources who you think are insightful on the subject. And so, you know, even if the bubble can't be precisely defined that you're in, like I'm in some kind of Erica bubble, right? Like you're in a Jay bubble, Neil's in a Neil bubble. And it's not that it's inherently wrong to be based in New York or DC. There's a lot of reasons to, I mean, DC is the seat of the federal government. So there will be a lot of reporters there. You know, New York is the center of the cable news industry. And so if you work in that field, like you will likely be there. And I think that what I've seen sometimes with my colleagues in mainstream media is just this sort of, this sort of bridling about being accused of being either biased or out of touch or not understanding, the quote unquote real American, which is a term I don't like either. And so I was just trying to say, like, I think that it would help us all to be aware that we're all going to have differential knowledge of some things based on where we are, what our job is, what our reporting is, or like how much experience we have in a certain area. So, that's fine. But I think that as long as we're kind of in this, I think if we can't acknowledge that even to ourselves, we're going to make the problem worse.
I agree. And what I like about your perspective, Erica, is that, it's kind of speaking against this tendency for people, I think predominantly on the right, to infer malice where there is none. There's this assumption that, well, the reason they're not covering this issue the way that I want them to cover it is because they are actively opposed to everything I believe, and therefore I must call them nasty names and dismiss absolutely everything they say. Their credibility is completely shot with me.
Yeah,
you know, and that's not good. That's not good for the industry. You know,
it's It's not. And we've seen these polls showing that, you know, the industry is having some troubles, right, as far as how many Americans trust, you know, the media as an institution collectively and so on. But, you know, at the same token, when as a journalist, when somebody asks me a very, very hostile question about my motive and character based on some, like, phrasing that they think is wrong, that doesn't make me more receptive to engaging with them on it. Especially because, and this is totally normal if you're not, like, a journalist writing for a magazine, right? But I remember 2 years ago, I'd written this story about open carry and guns. And so I was trying to be precise about, like, the terms I was using, because in the nature of the story, there's a discrepancy in Texas law between long guns and pistols, handguns. And I'm aware from having been in this industry for a while that, if you say, assault weapons when you mean long guns, that kind of conveys a lack of knowledge and a lack of concern for the people who are involved in this debate on the pro Second Amendment side. But in like the story context, I would use different terms based on which was most correct for the sentence, right? Mm-hmm. So somebody could kind of come in and ask me, well, why'd you say, I can't remember what it was, like, why'd you say AK-47? Because that's kind of a common mistake. There's like, no, this guy actually was carrying that gun, and he actually was carrying an AK, like we checked. Because we're trying to not have, like, too much repetition in the piece. And so I think that kind of discussion, I mean, can be had, but yeah, I mean, we're kind of in this, I don't know if it's getting worse nationally post-election, or if it's kind of, or if people are talking more, like, to each other across party lines or sort of tribal lines.
It could be both. It could be yeah. That people are talking to each other more, and it is getting worse. Who knows? But I take your point. You know, it's like, journalists aren't going to, quote unquote, get better if you attack them. And you can't doubt absolutely everything that someone is telling you just because they're in the New York Times or something like that. You know, it's a valid perspective and something everybody just needs to take a step back and, you know, just really think through what people mean, not necessarily get hung up on the legalism of the exact words they say. Now, was there anything in this article in particular that you found particularly disagreeable or that you disagreed with strongly, like anything that just didn't jibe well for you?
I'm not sure I had any terribly strong objections beyond, I mean, the sort of overarching one that this kind of examination is necessarily reductive, right? It's necessarily kind of broad strokes. Mm-hmm. I think that there's maybe a bit of an implication that, you know, contra the suggestion that media skews ideologically, it's actually geographic. I mean, there's, of course, like a relationship between those things, right? So you think about if you do like the map of where journalists are based and the map of where quote unquote elite college and universities are based, and then the map of, you know, sort of highest median income zip codes in the country, you'd see sort of clusters that keep overlapping, right? So I think it's possible to be, I mean, I would just keep in mind that there are, this isn't the only explanation for these things, right? But nothing that kind of struck out at me as a real howler. How about you? Did you have any strong?
Well, you know, the conclusion, which is that, you know, if missing the biggest political story in a generation, by which they mean the election of Donald Trump, won't change newsrooms, that nothing will. I mean, I wonder, yeah, are they just sort of like, are they misdiagnosing what the real problem is? I mean, I don't know, because I feel like they're, I mean, it's a very long article, it's very in-depth, but I feel like they're maybe giving, you know, some short shrift to the human nature aspect of it too. I mean, you can be right and be a jerk, and you can also be wrong and open to correction, or you can be vice versa. You can be wrong and a jerk and not open to correction, or you know, whatever. So I wonder though if it's as simple as, like, journalists don't like getting beat on a story or missing the story, and if that's a sufficient motive for them to address this issue.
Well, it could be a bit of that could be a bit of a glib conclusion. And I think that I agree with you. I think that I try to keep in mind, and of course, I think we all sometimes, I certainly sometimes fall short in this, you know, especially if I'm like really tired and like been working on an election for a long time. But I try to keep in mind presumption of good faith, of goodwill, of good intentions, the knowledge that language is inherently an imprecise medium for conveying meaning, right? I mean, that we're doing our best with the tools we have to capture some aspect of reality. And then also, I guess, back to the thing about epistemic liberalism, you mentioned Selena Zito. You know, she did really good work, and she was, you know, compared to most journalists, I mean, she was based in Pittsburgh for the Pittsburgh Tribune, and she was, you know, kind of saw the appeal of Trump early on. And so she, in the end, was right, because, like, Trump, you know, did win. But then, like, conversely, you know, I was right about Texas where I was. So the thing about Selena was seeing how Trump appealed to voters you wouldn't expect. I think that she, I mean, that makes sense for that area, and that has, you know, proved out in the polling result or the election results. But like in Texas, I mean, what I was seeing was Trump as a candidate who would underperform compared to most Republicans. I was not seeing like a subset of like Bernie Sanders people who were going to flip to Trump in the general. I mean, the kind of things that she was describing correctly about her area were sort of inverted in my state. And so I think that it's not that, this is not like, it's not a zero sum game, right? It's not like she has to be wrong for me to be right. That like we were both right about certain things, and we're kind of seeing different pieces of the puzzle, as were you and Georgia. I mean, so it's ultimately, in a country this size and this heterogeneous, with this much granularity, this much history, this much texture, we're going to need you know, a range of perspectives, I think, to try to get a more clear picture of what's going on.
That's interesting. That raises an interesting question for me. Let's flip this criticism around and turn it right back on the news consumer. Is this impulse to have a complete picture of the whole situation, is that possible? Is that healthy? Or is it healthier for people like Selena Zito to cover her part of the world and you to cover your part of the world and people in your markets to pay attention to what's going on in their part of the world and not worry so much about grand national trends? Is that part of the dissatisfaction?
Well, I think that people, you know, the human brain is sort of hardwired for narrative, right? We want to believe, especially in kind of uncertain times, in times where a lot of people were surprised and, you know, upset, like, we want there to be a clear explanation, a simple explanation. We want things to make sense, right? But I think that, you know, realistically, I guess for me, I'm comfortable with having to be curious forever, right? I mean, I want to hear about different parts of the country, not just different parts of the country, but different areas. And, you know, urban Texas versus rural Texas, rural West Texas versus rural East Texas. I mean, I'm curious about other people's points of view. And I think that, you know, we don't need to have a sort of unified theory of what happened in 2016 that's describes it all down to the describes it all down in a perfect narrative way.
Right.
I think that the downside risk of that is that then we become sort of wedded to the narrative, and we aren't able to see things that change in the future, right? I mean, it's like, if you tell a story, if you're in kind of a clear mindset, a clear camp, a clear story frame, Or even like sticking close to a clear model. I mean, there's a value to heuristics, but sometimes things change or there's something unusual going on, and it's important to be able to notice that when that happens.
Yeah, I think when I was reading through, the one part that I got to is that, like, it almost seems like one of the things that kind of bugged me is the area where it says, resist if you can the conservative reflex to observe this data and conclude that the media deliberately twists the news in favor of Democrats instead. Take it the way a social scientist would take it, the people who report, edit, produce, and publish news can't help but being affected, deeply affected by the environment around them. I kind of find that to be a little bit of nonsense. I think that they have their biases already, and the environment around them gives them comfort in expressing those opinions. That's the issue more. I don't think anybody, this whole idea that some journalist is going to D.C. or New York and he's just totally unaware of what he actually believes or in his own biases, and then somehow or another it becomes ingrained over time.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I mean, I think that's part of it with a bubble is, like, if you're a 21-year-old kid, 23-year-old kid, you move to the city and everyone around you thinks a certain way and you just never hear about stuff. I mean...
Yeah, but what kind of yokel is getting hired to write at a publication who doesn't have any kind of worldview on anything?
I
think you're both right. I think, in a way, another way to think about it, and this maybe is an angle that the story gave short shrift to, is that Of course, if you, you know, you don't just like show up out of the blue. You don't exist in a vacuum. Even if you're 21, like you're pretty raw at that stage, or you know, still have like soft spots in your head. But like you've got like some family, some history, some context that you're coming from. But I think that I can imagine how in like a newsroom in D.C. or in a certain publication, and I'm not actually imagining this because I've had this kind of experience before, but to have a sort of heterodox opinion is weirdly disincentivized. I mean, it's a terrible word, but like it's really like I think that there's certainly, and I would say too, there are journalists in D.C. and New York, and I think both conservative and progressive media who think for themselves, who are independent minded and who will express kind of contrary opinions to their own side or to the other side with courage and with clarity. But you know, it's like if every one of your friends is telling you, you know, sees it this way and you see it like some other weird way, you can start to question, you know, your perception. Or did we cut off?
Oh, no.
No, I can hear you. I think I heard a little echo there, but
I thought you were still continuing your thought. That's why I was kind of waiting.
Well, you know, and I talked to these other friends too, and especially I think for conservatives, this was a big thing in the Trump context, right? Because, you know, there were, so like for me, in my case, like from like July, like of 2015, I was like, nope. And so I sort of, you know, was too clear from the outset. But I think that for a lot of conservatives, and also I was not like in a context where I had to consider the ramifications for me as part of the tribe. If you were somebody who was, you know, like at Breitbart or at the National Review or like worked for Heritage Foundation or something, or you know, you would be thinking about, okay, so, how is this going to affect my professional outcomes for better or worse? Do all my friends think I'm crazy for saying this? So I can see how, even if you're not, being sort of inculcated in the mores of your bubble, that you might be, you know, less disposed to push back against the bubble, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Oh, it makes perfect sense.
Yes.
It makes perfect sense. Yeah. Anybody who's participated in a conversation or a debate with their conservative friends about, you know, certain politicians of the moment, you know, who are very popular with certain circles, and, you know, anybody who's dared voice criticism of what this or that conservative messiah has certainly come into that disincentivizing structure.
Well, yeah. Let me ask you this, and Neil, you can, you know, like your thoughts on this as well. But we'll start with Erica. You know, Neil was talking before about the consumer of news, and you have people that, you know, and I know people who have, you know, especially the older generation of viewers. Fox News has, you know, caters largely to an older crowd, but they put Fox News on in the morning and they turn it off when they go to bed at night. I mean, basically that's it. Fox News is where they get their news. If they go anywhere else, if they go on the internet, they're probably going to foxnews.com or maybe The Blaze or something like that, or conservative websites. You know, they'll come to Red State or something. But, you know, I guess in this whole bubble thing, is there any lessons that they can learn to sit there and say, you know what, we want to try and reach that audience that's watching Fox News, that maybe somehow or another we can get them to look at something else, not necessarily agree with us, but make them think about it and say, you know, because right now, I mean, I am so tired of everybody screaming fake news at each other that, you know, you know, if you link to something and say, oh, look what this person wrote here, I'm not reading that, fake news, it was, you know, so-and-so wrote it, it's garbage, forget it, that they won't even look at it. So how much, you know, does the mainstream media have in trying to kind of, you know, break the vice grip that certain outlets have on people? And what, you know, and then of course the consumer, what, you know, what falls on them to sit there and say, okay, I'll give this a chance.
Well, I would say for the mainstream media, if you're thinking about it from what I feel like as a journalist is my responsibility is just to try my best to be fair, to be candid, to be transparent about what my biases are, what maybe like my limits on what I know are, or kind of what my perspective is. I mean, and there's been times when it's not even occasionally, like, we can be in bubbles that are not about our worldview, but are about sort of framework of reference. So, like, if I'm thinking about unauthorized immigration, for example, I'm based in Texas, and I have a very, like, economics-y cast of mind, and so my instinct is to think about it as a labor force phenomenon, right? Not like a public security or national security or, you know, humanitarian issue first and foremost. So I have to kind of remind myself to think about it in those terms, but also, you know, sometimes I'll try to clarify that to readers if I'm not sure it's going to be ambiguous that I'm talking about, you know, Texas or this particular context or what I've seen in these past 10 years. As far as the consumer responsibility, I mean, I guess, you know, we can't, I mean, I haven't thought about it in those terms as far as what their responsibility is. I mean, it's a free country, right? But I think that if you're a consumer of news, people want to know the truth, and it's in their interest to get good information, to not get information from people who are just sort of shilling a line to them, right? And you never know, watching kind of the sort of antagonistic media on either side, who's sincere or not. I mean, you can kind of tell over time people who you think are honest brokers, you know, and they appear in various contexts, right? I think the byline or the individual TV anchor is more, I usually go by that rather than like the URL of the website. But I think for consumers, there are, I think, the bad sort of apples who are just trying to spin a narrative, trying to keep a captive audience. Part of keeping a captive audience is saying that everyone else is lying to you. Like, don't listen to them. They're telling, I mean, it's kind of a version of what you see in politics, right? With some politicians who are saying, well, I'm an outsider. I'm standing up to the establishment. I'm speaking truth to power. Therefore, anyone who criticizes me is preemptively delegitimized because the fact that they are criticizing me for anything proves what I'm telling you right now about how I'm telling you the truth and they're not, right?
Yep.
And so, which is just, you know, I mean, with for me, with Trump, watching Trump, part of it was that, and I've had to talk with people I'm close to who like Trump, and, you know, the usual constraint was ineffective. I can't read his mind. I don't know. But I was thinking, I'm somebody who cares about you. I don't think he's actually going to work hard for your interests. And, you know, I hope that now that he's president, he does work tirelessly for his supporters and for the country and for the world. But my sense early on was that is he really an honest steward if his kind of starting premise is the media which he loves is lying to you about, you know, and they don't care about you. So that was probably an overly long answer.
No, there's no long answers on this show. That's the best part about it. So let's kind of skip to you know, it kind of relates to the question that I asked, and then that was, you know, how does the conservative media fit into this? Because a lot of, I guess I saw a lot of conservatives, you know, kind of celebrating, you know, rah, 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 hey, we were right all along. But does the conservative media often have a problem with falling into the same bubble? I'm going to sit there and say, yes, you know, as a writer for Red State, and Red State overall was, you know, I mean, you know, most of our contributors were anti-Trump or part of the Never Trump movement, but we didn't. There were certain things that we didn't see. When I was sitting there watching those damn election returns that night, I was my eyes were just like wide open. Like, I can't believe that they haven't called Pennsylvania for Hillary Clinton yet. I cannot believe they haven't called Michigan for Hillary Clinton yet. And then as it went on, when I saw the margin of victory that he had in Ohio, I'm thinking, oh my God, this guy might actually win this thing. You know, whereas other people were like, weren't surprised.
I think I went to bed at 9 o'clock that night.
That's a one wake up call, isn't it?
I was surprised by Wisconsin. I think like Wisconsin, I was like, Wisconsin's like the designated driver of states. You know, it's like, it's a purple state. It's got like good Democrats, good Republicans. Like, Wisconsin will make their, and so, it was interesting. But to the question, yeah, no, I definitely think conservative media can fall into the same bubble. And actually, you know, I would say, you know, I don't know if I haven't mentioned this to you, but I mentioned it to Jay, but I'm working on this story about Breitbart, the outlet, for a California-based magazine. And in kind of, so Breitbart is headquartered in Los Angeles. Andrew Breitbart is from Brentwood, Los Angeles. And, yeah, so if you read, and he passed away in 2012, if you read his, you know, his biography, Righteous Indignation, or listen to his speeches or watch, you know, his documentary, yeah, he's very focused on the culture wars. And Breitbart started out as, you know, Andrew Breitbart's big journalism, Andrew Breitbart's big Hollywood. And so that was, and he has this kind of, this framework where he does have kind of what to me seems like a sort of conspiratorial outlook on like cultural Marxists and the Frankfurt School and like their efforts to kind of foment the workers' revolution by like, you know, starting a cultural leftist agenda. But then in like going to LA for the story and thinking about it, I kind of realized, well, if you were in LA, if you were in that bubble, like if you grew up in that bubble, you probably would feel that way because like Hollywood is very much like the bluest of blue bubbles, right?
Yes. Yes.
While I was out there, I had some friends. I had a friend who asked me with a very, very straight face if I knew anyone who voted for Trump. And I was like, oh my, really? Like, I haven't even asked that question. Of course I do. Like, there are Trump voters in my family. I have friends who voted for Trump. Like, I don't like Trump, but it doesn't, I mean, like, I was just kind of boggled. But he was serious, and he was sincere, and he looked troubled. He was like, I'm reading Breitbart. I started, you know, listening to Dennis Prager's and trying to figure out what I missed so badly. But then it kind of put in different context what I hear from California conservatives about how they feel like the left has achieved this hegemonic control. And of course, for me in Texas, like I wouldn't have occasion to just feel that way because I've seen conservatives win all the time. Like they win elections, they win arguments, they can govern. So the sort of sense of embattlement isn't intuitively understandable to me, but I can, you know.
But I think the story with Breitbart is he exported his siege mentality, you know, from this conservative in Los Angeles. He exported that mentality. It took fire on the internet, and conservatives in places like Texas or Virginia or Georgia internalized this, like you said, conspiratorial outlook. And I think it's a really good question to ask whether that was a fundamental error in Breitbart's approach, was thinking that, well, because my worldview and my experience is this, it must apply to people all across the country. And
absolutely. And I think exported that siege mentality is a good way to put it. And yeah, I'm thinking about it. I met him once in passing. I didn't know him. I think it might have been, it seems to me like this was his sincere feeling, but just misguided. You know, he'd gone from Brentwood, his childhood, to Tulane University in New Orleans. And I think also it was that he kind of was formed in these bubbles, but then also felt a sense of loss related to being in that bubble. It felt like unmoored, untethered to, you know, the values that his parents had espoused, that he was kind of not receptive to as a teenager in Los Angeles. And so his book is called Righteous Indignation. It's framed as indignation about what the left has done to the country. But there's a few moments where it's like, it's actually, you felt alone, or you felt lost. And you felt like you were unprotected from the world, that you had come kind of adrift from your roots. And that to me is, I disagree with him. I don't think it's ideal that this dialectic has emerged in the nation. But it's kind of made an impression on me that there was some sense of sadness, and fear, not just anger.
Yeah, I think like most people, I mean, he was complicated. He wasn't a caricature of a human being. He was a real human being, and he had complicated takes on the issues. And you know, he may have been mistaken, but he was certainly, I think, insightful enough to understand, you know, his own background and issues there. I look forward to reading this story.
It's been interesting. It's got a lot of like interesting sort of digressions. And of course, since I like major in philosophy, I'm like going in all these weird like little, you know, wormholes of like rabbit holes of investigation. But I think, I think that I've noticed this in general about people who are, as you say, complicated. I think that people on both sides of the aisle, in all tribes, I think that often they just want to feel heard and respected and valued and cared for. And in covering the primary, I think that I look at the primary map and it still kind of saddens me. I see Trump winning in states where people didn't have leaders or communities or advocates they already trusted before Trump showed up.
Right, right.
So I think that a site like Red State, like this podcast that you do, I think that there's to Andrew's insight, there's a role for conservative media that is representing this point of view fairly credibly and with empathy. But I mean, I'm not sure we can build out that apparatus now when everyone's so mad at each other.
Well, let's before we getting close to wrapping up here, but let me ask you about, you know, local based journalism. I mean, you know, you wrote for a Texas publication, and you know, I think we've seen a lot of the demise of kind of local journalism. You know, you don't see any. There's not a lot of small town newspapers anymore. I mean, there are, but it caters to a very, very small audience. There's just not. You know, I think part of the reason there's this bubble is that, you know, if you want to make a living as a journalist, you're going to have to probably go, you know, into one of these areas in order to find that kind of work. You know, you're not going to, it's going to be difficult if you want to go further. If you're living in Louisville, Kentucky, to you know, you may be able to get it. There's obviously they have their own newspaper, but it's not the way it was, say, 20 years ago, you know, when everybody was getting a newspaper. I mean, now it's rare that somebody gets a print newspaper delivered to their house, or they run out and say, I'm going to run out this morning and get the paper. You know, I remember being 24, yeah. 25. It's like Sunday morning, or whatever, or Saturday morning, I'd go down to the store and get coffee and the Daily News and New York Post and bring them back up and read them. And now you don't see that too often, but we've seen the return, you know, these kind of like, you know, these returns to, you know, records over CDs and other kinds of things where there's kind of this throwback thing. And we've seen, you know, for the Kindle was like huge, but now people are saying, you know what? I enjoy reading paper books. Do you ever think is there any possibility of maybe that kind of coming back, or is technology and the fact that the internet is so widespread that it's kind of done? What we've seen, what we've had before is over. What do you think?
Well, it's certainly in flux, right? Because as you say, there's the changes in the media industry concurrent with technological changes, concurrent with like the pace of news. Like, I mean, so I think one problem with for print right now, or one challenge is like, if you get the Sunday paper at midnight on Sunday, like it's almost like things can change very fast right now. By the time you send a story or print for like a monthly magazine, like who knows if it'll still, what else will have happened in the next week. Right. But I think of course, you know, I mean, journalism, kind of good journalism, takes time. It can cost money. And just to send a reporter out for 3 or 4 months to sort of start investigating a topic that's undercovered, that may or may not bear fruit as a story, really. I mean, like that can't really be replicated easily by Twitter or Facebook. And I think actually in the Trump context or the Trump era, there's actually going to be a real value to sort of old school reporting, like what's happening right now at the Energy Department. I mean, do we know? I mean, can we assign somebody to that beat to just like work it for a month or two? But on this hand, I do see more. There's of course more possibilities. I mean, like this podcast that we're doing is 3 people talking from different parts of the country. The possibility of doing a digital medium. I mean, we have in Texas the Texas Tribune, which is a relatively young nonprofit news organization that has the biggest newsroom in the Texas Capitol Press Corps. And covers the ledge, you know, very well because they've got a big reporting staff.
Oh, interesting.
There's a new paper or a new site. Yeah, actually, I mean, that's partly because, you know, the founder of it was such a kind of singular CEO, most journalists are not. But there's a new outfit called the Tyler Loop. It's in Tyler, Texas. That's, you know, reporting on Tyler. It's web-based. There's some guys who do good radio shows in West Texas, like West Texas Drive. And so I think that we have kind of the tools to make things more available. One thing I wonder about, and I mean, this is, just seems like a market failure to me, is, it seems like to Schaefer's point in the article, the media collectively, I mean, a lot of individual journalists did good work, but like the media collectively kind of blew it on a number of things. And the media is listening to recognize the need to, there's this whole like spate of stories about like understanding Trump voters when it's like, okay, like you probably should have seen the need to understand Trump voters before the actual election. But given that this need has now been made clear to everybody, it would be easy for a national outlet to hire somebody or you know, poach somebody in Louisville, Kentucky to be based there. And even if they were just based there writing about national politics, there would still be a certain granularity from being in Louisville, from talking to Kentuckians. from just, you know, hearing Louisville radio station on your way to work in the morning. And so maybe the problem with the bubble is not that there are too many journalists in New York and D.C., but that there aren't enough elsewhere.
Interesting. You know, and I think if it's a matter of money, I mean, the money concentrates in New York and D.C. and in California. Yeah. Well, here's the thing, though, when you're talking about web-based writing, you can pay someone. It's called direct deposit. You know, live, and you'd actually be paying them less than New York or D.C. or Southern California, salaries, because hey, cost of living's lower. So
yeah,
it might actually help out with the bottom line for some of these news orgs. So it's like disperse, send your tendrils out into the hinterlands and start having people write about national politics from, you know, Billings, Montana or wherever.
Yeah, because, you know, occasionally there are journalists who are, and another thing too, like the pipeline is such, like I happen to have been like started out at The Economist, but I was, you know, The Economist correspondent in Texas. So fortunately for me, I guess, like, I've always been able to talk to people at other sort of quote unquote elite media institutions or like interview for those jobs if I want them. But I think that, you know, if you're Politico magazine, or if you're The Atlantic, or if you're the National Review or the New Republic, and they do have some journalists who do this. But you could think about, you know, who happens to be a good commentator in Billings, in Des Moines, in St. Louis, because all these places are different too. It's not like they're just one undifferentiated mass of real America. I mean, these are 10 different places. They're all important.
Yeah, and it's interesting to kind of see that. You know, just give one little example here. This is before the election. And, you know, to give you an idea of the connection that Trump made with some people, you know, I live in the Atlanta area, which is, you know, for the most part, and even the suburbs, very, you know, wealthy area with your basic kind of like Republican voter base. I mean, in the three areas that I live near, Cobb County, Fulton County, and Gwinnett County, were three of the four counties that Marco Rubio won in the primary last year. But I was taking a ride up in northern Georgia, up into the mountain areas. They were taking a ride up to an apple orchard up there or something. And on the drive up, you would go past these tiny little homes, you know, that were, you know, some of them were ramshackle places that had these gigantic, and I don't mean like little tiny yard signs for Donald Trump out on their lawn. I'm talking like big, huge signs, you know, saying, you know, Trump 2016. I mean, and that, it all clicked and I was like, you know what? I said, this is what even I miss. And I live in this area, for crying out loud. So it's, you know, it's interesting. The whole bubble does affect everyone. I just didn't see that despite everything that I knew about this guy, because I lived in the New York area for so long. So I knew who he was. He, you know, Manhattan, you know, liberal, he's a Democrat, you know, but the things that he said, the way he talked about it, people were just like, yeah, I connect with that guy somehow or another. He was able to do it. So, so the bubble article was really good.
So good.
No, I was just saying, I think that, you know, in closing, it's just kind of like, you know, everybody needs to pay attention to it from time to time, you know, just kind of think, you know, so now it's like, why? Okay. So why did he win? And let's kind of remember that as we go down the road. You know, when we get, gosh forbid, you know, here in another couple of years when the re-election campaign starts. So,
yeah, and I think actually the only thing I'd add to that is that to the point about clarity and certainty, I mean, like, I find it very easy to accept that sometimes I'm wrong about stuff, and assuredly I will be wrong about things in the future, and I don't know what they are, and I won't know until after the fact what they are, so I just have to go around, you know, aware of the possibility, aware of my own fallibility, right? Which is fine. I mean, we're humans. Like, we're going to have gaps in our perception. So maybe cultivating that sort of acceptance of ourselves and each other.
Humility, I think you mean.
Epistemic humility, yeah.
All right. So, Erica Greeter, thank you so much for coming on. But before we let you go, we do have one more order of business. And we have one gotcha question that we provide to
our guests. This is Erica.
This is a very, very big, very important.
It is a matter of vital cultural importance. It's a matter on which Jay and I disagree rather severely, and we look to our guests to help resolve this issue and, and bring us into harmony or further disharmony, as the case may be. And Erica, that question is the TV show Seinfeld overrated?
Yeah, it is overrated. I mean, it's not that funny, is it?
Woo!
Oh, no.
Woo! You know what that is? You know what that is, Erica? That's the bubble that you live in that you realize you
It is, though. I'm not from New York, right? It's like, I don't...
I'm just giving you a hard time because you didn't agree with me. That's why.
Well, look, we're in the same bubble. We're in the same bubble on this one, Erica. And I'll tell you, it's a very small bubble because I think you're our second guest to say it's overrated. And we've asked probably 10 people this question. So.
Well, I think we're in good company, Neil. So
I agree. It's quality, not quantity.
Oh, man. Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Erica. And hopefully we can have you on again sometime.
I'd love to. Enjoy talking to you guys.
Thank you, Erica. Appreciate it. All right, everyone.
Have a nice evening.
All right. Thank you, Erica Greeter, everyone. Follow her on Twitter at Erica Greeter. Looks may look like Greider, I-E-D-R, but it's Greeter. So, but follow her there. She's got some interesting stuff to say. And so as we leave here, we tell you, you know, again, do us a favor. Go out there. Subscribe to this podcast. Review this podcast. Leave us 5 stars. We love it. We appreciate it. I'm Jay Caruso for Neil Dewing. We will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.